Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm your host, David Coletto. On this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by Eric Grenier, a senior writer and polls analyst at CBC. For over 10 years, Eric has been tracking the ups and downs of polls in Canada, and he manages the CBC's poll tracker and seat projection model. It's been a pleasure to get to know Eric over the past few years. He started doing seat projections right around the same time I started Abacus Data. He is, to some, Canada's Nate Silver. Or maybe it's more apt to describe Nate Silver as America's Eric Grenier. Either way, I'm really pleased he agreed to join the podcast. We talked about his journey in doing this work, how his seat projection model works, and what he's seeing in recent polls, and what we might expect with a possible federal election in 2021. I've always enjoyed chatting and connecting with Eric. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, Eric, thanks so much for joining the podcast. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So, for a lot of the listeners, for my students in my class, you are, and your work has become a fixture for them and other political watchers across the country. You're now a familiar face in probably most people's households, particularly those that follow politics and polling. And so before we get into your journey into this role and how you view polls and where the current landscape is, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the poll tracker works and how it turns the polls that companies like Abacus and others are putting out into seat projections and aggregates them into a polling average.
Well, the idea behind it is to try to keep things simple. So it's not overly complicated, but when it comes to getting the aggregate for the actual polls, it's just a weighted average that takes into account how old the poll is, how big the sample size is, and the track record of the polling firm, and melts that together to get an average that in the past has performed slightly better than just a normal average, sort of like the Real Clear Politics kind of average. So it does improve it a little bit, but it is primarily an average of the polls that are out most recently. And using those numbers, you can then make some seat projections. So the basic idea behind the seat projection model is that it is a proportional swing model. There's different kinds of models that are used, like a uniform swing model, which is popular primarily in the United Kingdom. But here, what I use is a proportional swing model. So to simplify it, if a party has improved its support since the last election by double, then their support in every single riding is going to be doubled as well. And there are some other factors that are taken into account, like incumbency and sometimes whether there's different candidates or something, you know, like if there's an independent MP or those kinds of things. But that is the basic idea behind it. And then using those seat projections, you can look at which races are the closest and gives you a bit of a range of the amount of seats that are in play. And if a party is able to outperform a little bit and win all of those close races, where that would put them. And if instead they lost them, what impact that would have.
So just have you been keeping count of how many elections you have been doing this, you know, and I know you've, before you were with CBC, you did this with the Globe and Mail and you were doing it on your own when you first talked, we'll talk about that journey, but how many elections have you actually been tracking and doing these kinds of projections for?
I think I counted it recently and it was somewhere around 30. So it's been quite a number of them. It's been pretty much every federal, provincial, some major municipal elections and U.S. elections going back to about 2008, 2009. So that ends up being a lot of elections when you have, you know, 10 different provinces holding them. I haven't done a Yukon one yet, but the last Yukon election 2016, I think was the day before the U.S. election. So it made it impossible to, you know, put a bit of an eye on it, but we'll see.
And I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, you require public polls to be able to do this. So in the case of like the Yukon or some of the smaller provinces, we often don't get as many public polls, which makes, I suspect, it harder for you to do the projections because you're relying on less data. Do you find over the course of those 30 elections that the model does better when you have more data, or is that just a fallacy of like big numbers that you don't need more polls to necessarily, you know, get closer to the final outcome?
I think that overall, if there's more, it's better. But if, you know, if you're looking at the BC election 2013 or Alberta in 2012, there were plenty of polls in those campaigns and it didn't really help. Whereas you can sometimes have an election in Atlantic Canada where maybe there's only 1-2 polls in the last week of the campaign, but if they nail it, then it'll do pretty well. And a C projection model can work pretty well. Though in those smaller provinces, it is harder, I find, to do the C projections. I've decided not to do them in places like Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland and Labrador because of the small amount of voters. It does mean that small swings can have huge impacts on local races. And also the local candidate is so important, especially in races in Newfoundland and Labrador. I've seen, where a party has 5% support, and then because they get a star candidate in the next campaign, they win it with 70. And there's no way you can model that kind of thing. You need that kind of local knowledge. And so I find in those kinds of races, it's better not to pretend that you can know things that maybe you don't just through the data. But when we're talking about races like in Ontario and Quebec and federally, that's where I think it can work a lot better and where it has had better performances in the past.
Are there other factors beyond, you know, as you just described, the size of a constituency, that the importance of a local candidate, that in your experience has an impact on whether an election is particularly easy or more challenging or more volatile, excluding the fact that when the polls are just wrong, your model can't work, right? So you pointed to Alberta and BC, at two elections I know well and completely experienced the failure of the polls to anticipate what was going on there. Are there other factors that make any particular election more challenging for you to anticipate how those polls turn into seats?
Often when there's a lot of change between one election and the next, that can be a bit more difficult to model, because when a party comes out of nowhere and starts winning a lot of seats, gets a lot more support, their voter coalition has changed a lot. So the way that their vote might have been distributed across a region in a previous election might change radically from one election to the next. It still makes it possible. I remember in the 2011 federal election, with the right numbers plugged into the model, I think the NDP was projected to win somewhere around 60 seats in Quebec. So it is possible when you have that kind of big shift. But for example, if you think about the last election in Quebec, one of the things that happened there was that the CAQ really outperformed in some parts of the province in a way that was a bit more surprising than you might have expected. We've seen that in the past with some parties. Their support is unexpectedly concentrated in particular regions of a province or of the country, and that can sometimes be hard to model. But in other campaigns where you don't see a lot of shifts from one election to the next, where it's just a couple points here or there, those tend to be a lot easier to call because you're not seeing big shifts in the coalition of voters that make up that party support. But even then, you can still have some surprises just based on some local races, some local factors. And, you know, if we think about the last federal election campaign, the polls did really well in most of the country, really well in Ontario and Quebec and other parts, really poorly in Alberta and Saskatchewan and Manitoba because it was lumped in with Saskatchewan. But that is the kind of thing that you can't really predict, that the polls are going to be dead on in Ontario, but off by 10 points in Alberta. It doesn't have a big impact on the results in that campaign, but still it does make it harder to know what's going to happen in some areas. In Alberta, for example, in the federal election, there was the expectations that at least a couple Liberal MPs, maybe one, Randy Abossino in Edmonton, might be able to survive. But when the Liberals underperformed their polls by so much, it just became impossible. Ralph Goodale, another one. I don't think anybody would have predicted that he was on the way out.
And so that, yeah, so when you have those differences, in even if it means that a handful of seats sort of go in a direction the model didn't expect, that then, affects the overall projection that you're making, right? That's interesting. And I think the other thing that's, you noted sort of those elections that are big changes, right? That are, you know, you see parties come out of nowhere, or you see a big shift. I think, 2015 saw the Liberals go from third to first. You saw the NDP in 2011 go from, 20 plus seats to 100 seats. And it's because your model still relies not exclusively, but its foundation is built off the previous few elections, right? You're looking at the history of votes in those ridings, and it builds into then projecting on the current polls how that seat might go, given the history plus the candidate plus what the polls are saying is happening in that particular region.
And that's why it works better in places like Ontario, where there tends not to be huge shifts in the way voters are thinking, but works more, has a bit more difficulty in places like Atlantic Canada, where voting for the Liberals or the PCs at the provincial level might not be that big of an ideological shift as it would be in some of the other provinces. But also I find what's really interesting, and what I find interesting about it all, is that you often learn things about what happened in an election through those errors. They're not random errors. It tells you something about a campaign that a party was able to withstand the trends because of some important local MPs, was able to appeal to a certain area of the country in a way that we didn't expect. So there is still something to learn from those errors and those mistakes. And I think that's actually one of the values, one of the things that I always take out of every election campaign, not just how close was it, but in the ways that it was wrong, what does it say about the races in those parts of the country?
Yeah, we always forget that, like, even though it's not always true and we don't experience an election in the same way, that there are 338 at the federal level individual elections going on. I wrote my dissertation on the value of the candidate, that local candidate. And to your point about when you see I did research on the 2004, 2006, and 2008 federal elections, because you had this like three elections in a very short period of time. And what that study showed was that the local candidate, particularly an incumbent, helps the party withstand swings against it, right? It becomes like this dam against a wave away from it. So so your model can't easily pick that up. You do try to account for candidate quality in some way, don't you?
A little bit. I used to use a model that looked at the last three elections, which is useful for those kinds of, like, if you think about an Alexandre Boulris in Montreal, and he should not survive the NDP's collapse in Quebec, but he has. So it can tell you something about those kinds of races. But then it also had the impact of overvaluing departed MPs and candidates. I went back to one election model, and it works a bit better that way. But I find the NDP in Quebec is one of those great examples, because their vote just collapsed in the last two elections in Quebec. But Boulris was able to mostly hold on to his vote. People like Ruth Ellen Brousseau, Guy Caron, and a couple other ones were able to withstand in a way that others just weren't. Their votes, if they weren't MPs or they weren't well-known MPs, their vote could collapse by 40 points, whereas those only saw a 10-point drop between 2011 and 2015. And in the case of Boulris, I think he kept his vote, or he hardly saw any of a shift in the last campaign. So it does show that some matter, but it is very specific. A no-name incumbent MP, with all due respect to no-name backbenchers, don't have that much value.
Right. So shifting gears slightly, first of all, would you self-identify as a journalist? Are you a journalist?
I've grappled with that question a lot. I work with a lot of great journalists, and so I feel like there's a standard there that I'm not sure I can always meet. I tend to think of myself a little bit more as more of an analyst, like an election analyst and that kind of thing, because I don't run down stories and work a lot through sources and that kind of thing. But I do a kind of journalism, and I am part of the Parliamentary Bureau and a part of the Press Gallery. So I'd say it's a high bar. So I don't want to claim that I can meet it, but I'd like to.
But you are one of the few, if not only, I can't even think of anyone who exclusively writes about and produces content for a news organization that has a lens through the polls, right? A lot of your stories, not all your stories talk about your poll tracker. A lot of them are trying to bring context to what's going on in Canadian politics or in US politics through what the polls are telling us, right? So it's a really interesting and I think unique part of what CBC and you are doing from that angle. So tell us a little bit about you know, your approach to the work you do, right? And, you know, if you think about, if you had a mandate, what is your mandate at the CBC? And what do you hope to deliver for readers and viewers of your analysis on TV and the digital content that you're producing every week?
Well, my mandate was more or less laid out for me when my former boss, Rob Russo, who was our bureau chief, who moved on to other things recently. We were sad to see him go. Chris Carter is our new bureau chief, so if he's listening, he's doing a great job. But Rob had given me that mandate of trying to make sense, not following the bouncing ball of individual polls, because there is a tendency sometimes in the media to focus on the ones that are interesting and ignore the ones that are not, which gives a warped view of how things are going. So my mandate and the way I kind of think about what my job is to try to make sense of it all for people in a way that goes beyond just what the latest numbers are showing, but what those numbers mean, what it can tell us about lots of other things that are happening in the election or political world. The idea behind something like the poll tracker is to try to bring a consensus of where the polls are so people don't have to pick and choose a pollster or a poll to, you know, put all their stock in. But increasingly, I've been trying to take as broad a view as I can on things. My background's in history, so I've also been trying to include a lot of coverage of the historical aspect of things, because I think sometimes in Canada we forget a lot about our history, particularly our political history. And that has been my approach, to try to take the broadest view possible. Whenever I do write about something that's happening in the polls, I almost always try to ensure I have two or three, because I want to be extremely confident in what I'm saying. I don't want it to be, here's one poll that came out, it must mean these important things, and we can, you know, extrapolate these broad trends out of this one set of numbers. I try to bring in as many as possible so that if anybody would challenge me on my conclusions, I can say, well, look, I have these three pieces of evidence, plus this other thing that's not involved with polls, but does kind of explain what's happening in the polls. So trying to, you know, if you've seen that that GIF from, what was it, Sunny Day in Philadelphia, I can't remember the name of that show.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
Yes, Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Yeah. I think it's him in that one, putting all the strings together of that conspiracy plot. It's sort of that, but a little bit less manic.
You're like a curator at a museum where you're bringing all the different evidence for people to make up their own minds in a way, right? Like you're saying, well, we've got these polls that say this, but then there's this that maybe suggests it's not happening. You know, these are the kind of conclusions we might make of it, but we'll see where the trends continue. No, I think there's a lot of value in that. And it just brings less volatility to the way that, you know, when I put out a poll, I'm going to make conclusions about my poll and say, this is what my data says. But you have that ability to sort of take a step back and say, okay, these polls are happening at different moments in time, using slightly different methods with slightly different questions. What can we actually conclude from it? And I think there's a lot of value in that. So,
well, like just off of that point, you know, that's where the journalism, I think, kind of comes in. If we're thinking about coverage of the pandemic, for example, you know, my colleagues who are there in the bureau or who work for maybe the health unit, they don't just talk to one expert. Now, the work that expert is doing is very important and their findings are very important, but they try to get multiple sources and bring it in all together to come up with a conclusion and a narrative, maybe sometimes bringing forward contradictory evidence to kind of show the people it's not, you know, it's not as clear cut as that. And that's sort of what I do. It's taking in all of these different sources to give people an explanation of what's going on. Not that those individual, you know, pieces of information are less important, but they're part of the overall story.
So just quickly, because I think people who know you as well as I do know that, you know, this, what you're doing now for a living, I don't suspect you thought you would be doing when you started in post-secondary, or you were sort of plotting out your career. Give us a little bit about sort of how you got here, because from what I understand, you didn't study statistics or modeling or anything like that in university. And yet, you know, I call you, and in the intro we said, you know, you are the Nate Silver for Canada, or Nate Silver is the Eric Grenier in the United States. You created your own journey here. You're an entrepreneur in a way too. Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are.
Yeah, well, no, I didn't study statistics, which I regret now. I wish that I had in high school and in university. No, I studied history. History has always been my biggest interest, and my intention was to become a history professor one day. In the end, I decided I wasn't going to put in all the hard work to get a PhD like you did. So after university finished, I wanted to go into writing, and I started writing mostly history articles, that kind of thing. And Nate Silver had launched his site 538 in 2008 for the coverage of the US election. And I found that the work that he was doing there was just so interesting because I was interested in politics, but not perhaps as interested in some other people at the time. And I found that the approach he took really helped me understand what was going on in that campaign, because I did find it was hard to know what was really happening. There was the perception that the race between Barack Obama and John McCain sometimes might have been closer than it actually was. And so I followed his coverage of that campaign in 2008, and I figured, I'd like to try my hand at doing this myself. So when I first started my site 308 in 2008, when I looked back at some of the old articles, I'm not that proud of them. They were pretty amateurish, and it took a while for me to develop an expertise, but I always was interested in numbers. I was the kind of person who, would write down hockey statistics when I was a kid. And so I was always interested in that approach. I've always loved maps. I've always loved charts. So it just seemed like a natural approach for me. And I like taking that approach to politics of being able to kind of step back and have more or less irrefutable evidence, just numbers. And, that was my interest in it. And I started my site in 2008. I plodded along for a couple of years, and eventually I was able to pitch to the Globe and Mail that I could write for them. And then it became not a hobby anymore. And it became the start of a career, which I was not expecting would bring me where I am today.
Very cool. Yeah, it reminds me of, people always ask me, like, did you always want to be a pollster? And even yesterday, I was doing a class at Carleton, this sort of professional development, talking about their careers and journeys. And someone said, when did you decide this is what you want to do? And I can't think of the day. But in you reflecting on looking at hockey stats, I was that kid who at the time, this I'm starting to age myself, I would get the Toronto Star. And I would go to the sports section and go to the baseball box scores. And like, I would be there looking at stats. And so I guess to your point, there is this, like, we have that common experience where we're attracted to numbers. We're attracted to the story that they can tell. And then I'm the same with you, maps and charts or something that I very visual. So it's just a lot of, it's really interesting. I think there, for others that are in our kind of world who do work in data and do work in storytelling, which is what we do, there's probably a lot of symmetry there and a lot of similarities. I am interested in your take on, as someone who's on the media side of the polling world, what you think about the relationship between polling and the news media, right? I think it's a complicated one. I often hear that journalists and media organizations focus too much on horse race polls, that the focus turns politics into a sport with so much of that focus on who's ups and down. I know for a fact that when I release a survey that has horse race numbers, I get 20 to sometimes 100% more visitors to my website than when I release a very thoughtful piece on an issue or what issues Canadians are caring about. So there's no doubt that there's far more interest in the horse race from the consumers of the content we produce. But what's your sense of that relationship? And from your perspective, I'll share mine after, but I am curious after, almost more than a decade of doing this, and now you are firmly in the fifth estate. What do you think about it all?
It's interesting you mentioned how it gets so much more traffic on your site, because I think some of the sort of the tut-tutting about the horse race and this kind of is telling people what they should be interested in. And I think that when people are able to find a way to get interested in politics. I think it's a way to, we should be encouraging that in a way. You know, when you just talk about hockey statistics, right, it becomes almost a bit of a gateway into understanding things. If you're interested in it, I think there's some value in it. And, you know, for a lot of Canadians, when they're talking about an election campaign, you know, they are interested in how the leaders are doing. They listen to the platform promises. But one of the biggest questions they probably have in an election campaign is, who is going to win this? So I think there is some value in trying to answer that question in the best way possible. But in terms of the the relationship between the media and pollsters, as you know, it's changed a lot. When I've spoken to some veterans of journalism, that the relationship was greatly different in the past, that there was a much more intimate relationship between pollsters and the media, that media was paying pollsters to do the work and so had a big stake in the numbers that were being presented and could work with pollsters to develop questions, develop sort of the rollout for it. I think that in it, that had a lot of value because it was a lot of high quality polling that was being paid for and being done in the most responsible way possible. But I think there is also an odd conflict when there is a relationship between a media outlet and a pollster, because it incentivizes that media outlet to put a lot of value on that pollster's numbers, sometimes to the exclusion of contradictory evidence that's being produced by other pollsters. So I think that having a broad view of everything that is out there is really important. And if you have a narrow view, that you might be missing some of what's going on. There is that idea that the media likes polls because they're easy, that they're easy to write up, and then there you go, you got. I'm not sure that a lot of journalists are motivated by that. They're busy enough. They don't need to have another thing to do. And so I don't think they're looking for polls to make their jobs easier. But because the public's interested in them, there's an interest in doing them. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. The horse race coverage during a campaign, if it is displacing the work of more in-depth analysis of policy proposals and what the leaders are saying, I think that would be a negative thing. I think that's the advantage that I bring, is that the CBC leaves that stuff to me. So no one's being assigned, no one who has a lot more knowledge about other things is being assigned to do poll coverage. And we've seen in campaigns that the horse race can be really important because it changes the coverage of a race in a way that I think is relevant to Canadians. If you're in a race that is on track for a big majority for one party, then a lot of the focus probably has to be on what that party is going to do when it's in power. If instead the polls are suggesting there's going to be a minority government, then voters need to know how is that going to work? What are the parties going to, what can they agree on? What can they not? Who is going to have a seat at the table? I think those are important questions to ask before people vote, as well as after the results are in.
And I always use the 2011 election as the example, that the polls, as much as the news media take cues from the polls on who's likely to win, who's likely to play a role in parliament, who may have more influence, they also help signal, how much coverage should the different parties get. The NDP and the Greens will perennially complain that they don't get enough coverage. And it's largely because the odds of them winning the election at any given time are still pretty low until they're not. And when they're not, I think the 2011 election offers a lot of insight that if the polls didn't pick up, or there weren't public polls picking up the rise of the New Democrats in Quebec and then the rest of the country, Jack Layton and the New Democrats in those final weeks of the campaign probably wouldn't have got as much coverage as they did, for benefit and worse. More coverage doesn't always mean a good thing.
Right.
Because the media starts scrutinizing and asking more questions about what it is you're going to do if you do win the election. But I think they help frame for both journalists and the public what the choices are. And in our system, where, as for those who hate the first past the post system, it is the system we have. And so the system distorts the seats, as your seat projections often show. In that way. So I really think that there's a value. And in terms of the relationship, there was a moment a few years ago where it seemed like, you know, there was a lot more conflict and, you know, some polls being put out and pollsters criticizing each other. That seems to have subsided quite a bit. I always say, you know, as a pollster myself, that we somehow have pretty big egos and our poll is the only poll and we should ignore everything else. I try not to approach that in my work, recognizing that the limits of my poll are the same as everybody else's, and your work helps, I think, bring some focus on that. But I think the relationship's improved a bit, but we still get during every election, I always tell this story too. I'm inevitably called by a journalist who is pre-writing the story on why the polls failed that night, right? And then I ask, well, are you writing the story about how awesome we did? And they say, no, why would we write that story, right? So at least, you know, I think from my perspective, at least you hammer us when we deserve it, but you give us kudos when we deserve it too. And I think that's helpful in keeping people's perspective on what polls can and can't do in predicting elections. They do a pretty good job at, I think, still picking up how people are feeling at any given moment. Okay, last point. We're recording this on March 3rd, so this is the time sensitive part of the discussion. I'm curious of your take on where Canadian politics is today. You know, we've come out of a month in which some of the polls, ours included, have shown, you know, the Liberals under a little bit of pressure, government approval rating down, feelings about the Prime Minister a little more negative, a slightly tighter race, some polls suggesting that's not the case, but it appears that may be moving in a different direction now. And there's a good chance, although I don't know what I base that good chance on, I have a sense there's a good chance that we're headed into an election at some point in 2021. What's your take on public opinion today and as it relates to politics in Canada?
Well, what's interesting to me is that the numbers really haven't moved all that much in the last 6 to 7 months. So it suggests that for a lot of Canadians, they're kind of okay with where their vote is parked right now. I think it is interesting seeing in the recent weeks how the Liberal vote, I think, has softened. Even if, as you said, some pollsters have not shown that the Liberal vote itself has dropped, it's clear that their underlying sort of you know, foundations are getting weaker, right? Because the popularity of the Prime Minister has dropped, his approval ratings have gone down. And that means that it is easier for the other parties to chip away Liberal support if their leader is not as popular as he once was. What I find is really fascinating about it is that the Conservatives have just not been able to take advantage of it. No matter what poll you're looking at, even the ones that have the Liberals far ahead or a very tight race, it's just because of the Liberal number. The Conservative number is always somewhere between 30, 31, 32. Sometimes it dips below 30. They have just been unable to move the dial at all. And I think that should be a deep concern for the Conservatives. They have a new leader. They got no honeymoon out of that whatsoever. And we're seeing in lots of different polls that Erin O'Toole's numbers are worse than Andrew Scheer's were at about this stage of his leadership. So that, I think, would give the Liberals a lot of comfort that if they do go into a campaign, it's more likely that O'Toole's unfavorables could increase or that he won't be able to get back, you know, over water over the course of a campaign. And so they might be able to win a bit by default. They can look back at the pandemic. If the time that election takes place, the vaccines are starting to roll out, they can get 34, 35% of the vote. And if the Conservatives are too weak in Ontario and Quebec, they could theoretically squeak by with a tiny majority government. The NDP has been doing a bit better in polls, it seems, and might be able to get a bit of return on that. But I think they're still far away from really challenging, as is usually the case. But yeah, I think it's a really fascinating kind of place because none of the parties are really that strong. They have some underlying weaknesses. They have a couple of opportunities. Maybe the Bloc Québécois continues to be a factor that's going to take a lot of seats off the table in Quebec. You have Annamie Paul in the Greens, who is a bit of a wild card, not sure what kind of impact she will have in the course of a campaign. So if I was trying to figure out, should you know, I recommend to my party that we try to force an election anytime soon, I would not be confident about saying that it's a good time to take a gamble on any of that.
Because it feels really uncertain and unpredictable. And I think there's probably a few factors there. One of them is we're in the middle of the pandemic still. I don't think most people have really thought about their choices, right? I've been using this analogy more and more as like, you know, voting is like going into a restaurant and you sit down and you're handed the menu. And until you get there, you usually don't really think about what you're going to eat. You might have a preference. Oh, today I feel like maybe, you know, a steak, or maybe I'll have pasta, but I don't really know. And you often start with what I had in the past. But the moment you sit down and you start to say, okay, do I want something different than what I got last time? And, you know, the steak doesn't look that good this today, or you ask the chef, you know, that's when you start sort of firming up those pre-existing views. So at the end of the day, while everybody focuses on the horse race, in a time like this, it's probably the least indicator, the least effective indicator at likely where things might be, right? And I think you also report a lot on like approval ratings and how people feel about the leaders. And, you know, I was just looking this morning at some of our data. Back at our last survey in the last election, 30% of Canadians had a very negative view of the prime minister. Today it's at 23, right? And so what does that signal to me? It means first that like if you're Erin O'Toole and Andrew Scheer, the previous leader, really did well by tapping into some of the anger that was there for Justin Trudeau and the Liberals, particularly in Alberta and some of the, why we saw turnout, I think, jump so high in so many of those ridings, doesn't appear to be there right now. So you can't really play on that energy. And so there's a lot of volatility, right? People aren't enthused about the Liberals, but they're not deeply unsatisfied. The more they get to see Erin O'Toole, then they're not enthused about him either. In fact, he's turning more people off than he's bringing them on board. And the New Democrats, I think, continue to struggle with like, why us versus the others? So that signals, I think, we're together, a lot of potential volatility as we get closer whenever this election might happen, and a lot of minefields and opportunities between now and whenever that happens, a budget, a recovery, vaccine rollout. You know, I think the longer this goes on, the more people are gonna be happy. And I'm not sure whether that creates an opportunity for people to say, change wouldn't be that bad right now because things are getting better, or why would we change when things are going so well? So lots of variables to make sense of it, but.
I had written a piece recently. I'd looked at polls going back to the Second World War, the old Gallup poll and all that. And generally what I concluded was that if you go into a campaign with anything less than a 9-point lead, you can't take it for granted. And that's a big lead. We haven't seen anything like that in the polls recently. So anybody who looks at the polls right now and says, oh, the Liberals are up by, you know, a couple points, and hey, they're doing pretty well in Ontario and Quebec, they should probably go to an election and then win a majority. Yeah, after 6 weeks, who knows what the end of that will be. And in just thinking of in terms of spring election, you know, I think a lot of parties looked at what happened in New Brunswick, BC, Saskatchewan, said, look, everything went fine, incumbents reelected, so, you know, we don't need to worry about it. And you had Newfoundland and Labrador, where there was almost zero cases. And now all of a sudden it's going to, their election results are going to be delayed by maybe up to 2 months. So you can't take anything for granted. A spring election to me just still seems like the biggest gamble you can make. A fall election would make a lot more sense, especially because Ontario and Quebec are having the provincial elections next year, which crowds the calendar. But, you know, we've seen in the past that sometimes politicians do not always make the rational decisions when it comes to election timing.
And once that ball starts rolling, you can't stop it, right? So, well, Eric, thank you, and appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. Always, you know, we talk offline all the time, and it's always good to connect and see you. And really appreciate you taking the time.
All right, well, it was fun. Thanks.